at jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more.
This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner-Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning, and welcome to Community Matters. My name is Laura Sumner-Kuhn, and I'm your host for today. This is our second installment of a series we're doing calling Recognizing Racism, and I'm absolutely delighted to have three distinguished guests with us today. We'll start the day with a introduction for all three, and then I want to just take some time to have them tell you a little bit about their personal and professional journeys. And I'll just start now with a brief introduction of each. So one of our guests is attorney Angela Cunningham. Angela is the owner of ADC Law Office in Kenosha. She grew up in Wilmot, attended Wilmot High School in Kenosha County, and went to UW, where she earned degrees in social welfare and women's studies and a master's in social work. And she got her law degree from Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. She's a former public interest attorney and a former prosecutor in Milwaukee, and she worked for the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office, and I understand that she is eyeing perhaps a run for the U.S. House of Representatives in District 1. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you.
I will also, I'm also pleased that we have Judge Milton Childs with us. He was appointed in October to the Milwaukee Circuit Court bench. He was born and raised in Milwaukee. He has an interesting path as a math teacher, a U.S. Marine Corps of Reserves veteran. He got his law degree from Marquette University. He has been in private practice. He was a former public defender in Racine, Sheboygan, and Milwaukee, and now he sits on the Milwaukee Circuit Court bench. Welcome, Judge Childs.
Thank you. Thank you.
And then I turn to Darren Crawford, who is a Racine public defender right now, but he has been a public defender in Detroit, in Green Bay, and Milwaukee. And you might have seen Darren's presence recently in coverage in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He had taken place in a protest march on June 8th, where he stopped to address the peaceful marchers to explain his personal experiences being a victim of racial profiling. And I'm sure he can share much more with what he encounters with his clients as well. So welcome, Darren.
Thank you.
Thanks. So I've asked each of our guests to start today with just giving us a glimmer of who they are and what they have experienced. All three of my guests are people of color. And since we are focusing on recognizing racism, I think we have so much to learn just by simply listening to their journeys. And so I'd like to start with you, Angela, if you could share with us your journey from Wilmot to attorney.
Thank you, Laura. I am not just a person of color. I am a proud Black woman. I was born actually in North Chicago, Illinois, and when I was 12 years old, we moved to Western Kenosha County. It was actually Trevor, Wisconsin, because my mom got into the Habitat for Humanity program, and so we were able to build a home out there. I distinctly remember asking my mom what the kids at the school were like after she told me she had registered my sister and I for school. Because in North Chicago, most of my friends were Black and Latino, and I recognized that where we were moving, we would be the only people of color at our school. We made the transition. I was not happy, I'll be honest. It was a very difficult transition, but I eventually adapted, got involved in high school, went to Wilmot High School, where, again, my sister and I were the only African Americans initially, until a group home was built out in Western Kenosha County. I believe it was opened out in Silver Lake. And as you can imagine, and I'm sure the two individuals on the phone who are involved in the criminal justice system can imagine, the occupants of that group home were Black, Black boys that came to the high school. And I think that was the first time I experienced overt racism, in that they had a difficult time integrating with others in the school. And I remember one day, I think I was a sophomore when they first started coming to the school, and walking out to the parking lot, and someone spray painted the words "Go home" N-word multiple times in the parking lot. And I think that was the first time that it hit me that there was a real problem with racism. Because as I mentioned before, living in North Chicago, most of the people I was around were minorities. And then coming as a child, we didn't see much of that, but once I didn't at least perceive much of it, I should say. But that really hit me. And as I think back on it as an adult, I remember the next morning when we came to school, everything was painted over, but I don't recall any counselors reaching out to me. I don't recall any conversations being had in the school about what that was about, and how that may have affected me or other classmates. After graduating...
Oh, I'm sorry. What kind of ramifications does that have for you? I mean, what, looking back on it now, do you see how it really impacted you at all?
It's kind of hard to put it to words. It impacted me. I knew it impacted me at the time that it happened. But how to say how much that impacted me versus other kind of micro, not in your face, overt racist things that I also dealt with as being one of the only minorities in the school, I can say I can't say that that was, I mean, it was in my face, but I can't say that it impacted me more or less than other. You know, things like when I first moved to Trevor, I remember my English teacher had us read an assignment in front of the class. And after I read, the English teacher made a comment about how I talked different than everybody else. So I would say that that probably wasn't an overt racist comment, but comments like that along the way, as I look back, I think affected me just as much, if not more, as the overt spray painting in the parking lot. But there was never any real conversations about it with administration or principals or teachers. It just wasn't talked about. And I think that is problematic, especially not just for me as a Black woman, but for the other students who are missing out on the opportunity to have conversations about race and what it means and how to address someone who may not look like most of your friends and your peers, and what it means to have a racist attitude or a racist, or to be a racist, I guess you could say.
Sure.
I think my high school experience caused me to want to go in the complete opposite direction. So I decided to go to a HBCU. I actually started college at Xavier University of Louisiana.
I'm going to interrupt for just a second for our listeners.
Yeah.
You went to a historical Black university, right?
HBCU. That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And that's in New Orleans, Louisiana. I actually became pregnant after my first year of school, so I came back to Wisconsin and transferred so that I could be closer to family, and transferred to University of Wisconsin-Madison, and that's where I finished my undergraduate degree and the master's degree. While at Madison, I experienced more racist incidents, more overt racist incidents. I distinctly recall one time walking down the street on campus, and a group of white kids, I don't know if they were kids, if they were college students, they were definitely on the younger side, yelling, "Go home," N-word, out the car as I was walking down the street.
Can you give us a time for this? Because I think we live in this false sense of, well, maybe not so much today, but we had been, I think, white people especially, lulled in this country to think that racism doesn't exist anymore because we don't experience it. And yet all of these things happen every single day to people. And I think some people might think, well, this was an historical moment, but it probably wasn't that very long ago, correct?
This was probably, it was less than 20 years ago.
Sure.
Because it was after my son was born, and shortly, I was in Madison for about 6 years, so I can't say for sure if it was at the beginning of my stay in Madison or the end of my stay in Madison. But it definitely was something that stood out as an experience. After finishing my master's degree, I worked in social services for a few years, came back to the Kenosha area. I became the executive director of a grassroots nonprofit organization. And while working there, I had a lot of clients who were living paycheck to paycheck, a lot who were homeless. And I realized that a lot of my clients had legal issues that were further compounding their situations, and there weren't very many resources around for them to get help with those legal issues. So then that's when I decided to go to law school. Northwestern at the time was trying out a 2-year accelerated JD program, and I applied and got accepted. It was specifically geared towards career changers, and the idea was that basically get in and get out and save a year of expenses as far as living expenses go. The degree still costs the same amount, but it's one less year of loss of income because you're spending it in school. After I finished my degree at Northwestern, I did come back to the Kenosha area and worked in social services with legal action, representing victims of domestic abuse in family law cases. While I was a law student, I interned at the state's attorney's office in Chicago and also at the district attorney's office here in Kenosha. And I realized that I wanted to work in criminal law. I also had this mindset that I would get into a district attorney's office and change things from the inside. I was disillusioned when I actually got a job at the district attorney's office in Milwaukee. When that opportunity came up, I did jump on it. I was especially excited about getting the job in Milwaukee because I learned about John Chisholm, and he's nationally known for being a more progressive district attorney. And I thought, wow, this would be a perfect opportunity for me to be able to get into the office and make a change from the inside out. But I quickly realized that that was not the case. Internally, the office, I felt, was not as progressive as I think nationally it seems to get recognition for. And I was continually frustrated because I worked with a lot of colleagues who the only access or experience they had with people of color or low-income people was on the cases they prosecuted. They didn't live with people of color. They didn't live near people of color. They were not in proximity with anybody of color. And I don't care what anybody says. We are humans. And when you are the only experience you have with a certain population of people is in the criminal justice system and alleged crimes that they've committed, and that's all you see, you're going to start to build up a certain idea about a certain population. And I would hear that in some of the comments with some of my colleagues. It wasn't overt racism, again, like I mentioned before, but just certain comments here and there that showed me that there was a certain mindset that existed with some of my colleagues.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but talking about microaggressions, and I don't know that many, you know, there are a lot of people who still lack an understanding of what that means. And perhaps you would like to expound a little bit about what you encountered, just as, you know, just from your description just now. What kinds of things would you hear that you would, that you wouldn't consider overt but were definitely racist in at their core?
Absolutely. Some common ones that I've gotten over the years are you're the whitest black girl I've ever met. Or I don't see you as black. That makes me sound like there's a certain perception of what a black person is like. And it automatically assumes that that perception is negative, and this is a backhanded compliment that I'm receiving because I don't fit that perception. That's definitely a huge microaggression. And when I was younger, I didn't recognize it as that. But as I've gotten older and learned more and educated myself more, I start to think, yeah, that's not okay. And as I speak up about it and let people know, most people understand that. They may get a little bit defensive, but I think a lot of those comments are out of ignorance. And so I am trying to be more cognizant of informing people about their assumptions and how their comments show underlying assumptions that they may not realize.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm going to stop you for a second and we'll get back to you, but maybe we'll now switch a little bit so we have Judge Childs have a chance to introduce some of his background, and we'll come back to talk as a group. So Angela, thanks, and we'll get back to you in a second. Judge Childs, can you talk to us a little bit about your experiences, both personally and professionally?
Yes, and thank you again, Laura, for setting this up. As was mentioned, I'm born and raised in Milwaukee, lived the first 17 years of my life. There's a zip code that is known nationwide, 53206, known as the most incarcerated zip code in the country. Now it's the second most. There's another one that kind of took over the lead. But that was my home for the first 17 years of my life. Born and raised, I went to school there, I lived there, went to church there. And for me, that was where that was my home, and I was very comfortable in that environment. Born and raised, for undergrad, interestingly, Angela went to Xavier. I went to Xavier also, Angela. Xavier
what?
University, yeah, in New Orleans. And I
small
finished,
world.
I love New Orleans. I was able to graduate it. And it, for me, it was a great experience coming from Milwaukee to go to a black college where you see people that look like you striving and wanting so much more, black professors. I learned black history. I learned so much history, black history, that I had not learned in MPS. I went to Milwaukee Public Schools all 12 years of my life. So it's a great experience for me. What was interesting, in New Orleans is the South, of course. There were certain areas of Louisiana right around New Orleans that I was told, don't go, you know, venture into at nighttime because it's still the South. And so it was pretty, there was open racism at that point. I too was called the N-word. I remember I was catching the bus, a place called Metairie, Louisiana, which is right outside New Orleans. And I'm standing on a bus stop, someone drove by and threw some beer bottles at me and called me the N-word. But besides that, the experience in New Orleans was a great experience. And it was what I needed. just to see more people of color in a positive light. So came back to Milwaukee for some reason. And then ultimately I ended up being a high school math teacher. And I taught at this alternative high school, Cornerstone Achievement Academy. And the focus was on students, at-risk students. And it was those students who kind of helped encourage me, and I ended up coming to court and representing or speaking on behalf of them as their teacher in several juvenile court hearings. And at that point, I saw some of the attorneys that they had. I was like, I can do what they're doing. So I decided to go to law school. So I did the part-time program at Marquette. I taught during the daytime and then went to law school at night. My first true experience with this system as a victim or potential defendant, it was my first year in law school, September of 99. First year Marquette Law, it was in the evening, it was September evening, and I was jogging. And I still live in it's a pretty diverse neighborhood. Nice evening, it was still light outside. I was jogging, and all of a sudden, I was told to freeze, and then two guns were pulled on me, and these were two Milwaukee police officers. One was white, one was black, and they pulled their guns at me. They threw me on the ground. The gun was to my head. I was searched, and at this point, I was in jogging clothes. I had shorts and a T-shirt on, and then I was put in the back of a squad car. Was not told why. I was back in the squad car maybe 15 to 20 minutes, and I heard on the dispatch that the suspects had been apprehended. So a few minutes later, the police officers came to me and told me, finally they told me what happened. There's a Walgreens not far from where I live that was robbed, and the suspects looked like me, so that's why they stopped me. I told them I have shorts and a T-shirt on, I don't have a gun, but it wasn't worth arguing at that point. But I always remember the guy told me, you probably shouldn't be jogging at night. And this is my neighborhood and I can't do what I want to do just because of their biases or whatever they have in regards to what was happening. So that kind of concreted my desire at that point to become a defense attorney. So I graduated from Marquette and then I got a job with the public defender's office. And initially, I was placed in the Sheboygan office. Sheboygan was a great experience for me. For the most part, it was positive. Initially, I had several clients that did not want me to represent them. Several times, when they saw my face and found out that I was a black male, I was told several times that they want a new attorney. Over time, I was able to have clients and have individuals represent me. And Sheboygan was a great learning experience. Then I had a chance to go into private practice for about a year. And I came back to the public defender's office and I practiced in Racine County. And Racine was very interesting. Racine to me seemed more prejudiced in some areas of the South.
That's interesting. Can you give us some examples?
I was told initially with Racine, you have this east of the I and west of the I of the interstate, mm-hmm. and how pretty much different individuals regard depending on where you live. But so many of the blacks that I ran into in Racine, I don't know, a lot of them just didn't seem to have the drive, and a lot of them were complacent in where they were. They were frustrated with the system, but a lot of them just didn't have the fight or the drive to try to change the system. And I felt the DA's office in Racine was just terrible in regards to providing good offers. Part of when you talked about this system, this biased system, there are so many levels in the system. And I think Racine for me was eye-opening in regards to the bias from the police officers, the stops that they make, and that the discretion that they have in regards to giving a person a ticket or arresting them. Clearly, most of the people of color were arrested, especially if you were from Milwaukee. They gave you a cash bail most times because they felt that you were not going to come back to court. And then the court system itself was, in my opinion, biased also in regards to people of color. Many of them got jail sentences, unlike some of the white clients that I represented who would get probation. So, yeah.
Racism. Right. We're going to come back to talking in our second half of this two-part interview about some of the things that you've encountered in the system and how they can be changing. But one of the things that I think you're mentioning is that there's a great deal of discretion that all along the chain somebody could make. That makes, in some cases, a difference between life and death, or incarceration or no incarceration. All along the chain of command there, in, you know, standing on the street jogging, for instance. So those are wonderful examples. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just wanted to make a plug that we will be coming back to talk even deeper about some of these systemic racist things that happen in our criminal justice system.
Thank you, and I totally agree. So I look forward to that discussion as well.
So then when you were in Racine, where did you go from there?
Racine, so I wanted to get back to working with juveniles. So from Racine, I transferred to the Milwaukee Juvenile and the Mental Health Office of the State Public Defender's Office. And it was there, you know, came back to Milwaukee and had a chance to work with the youth and saw many of the similar biases that were in the adult system in regards to race. Same thing was happening with our juvenile system. And again, we'll talk about it more, but you know, part of my issue with many, especially of the juveniles in the Milwaukee system, is a lot of these kids got involved in the system through school. Mm. A lot of it was being arrested at school by the resource officers. Those, you know, police officers within the school. So that's, you know, as we talk more, that's one of the, I think, issues or concerns that many people have in regards to police officers in school and how people of color, children of color, tend to be more picked out and processed because of their color than other individuals in the school system.
Right. I think for those who have been enlightened by what's been happening over the years, it has even become the pipeline to our prisons and a great concern, or should be a great concern to all of us.
Yes. And another pipeline that I saw as well out of Children's Court was the child welfare pipeline. You know, kids that are caught up in the child welfare system initially as children that need assistance. They call them CHIPS kids, children that need services. Then all of a sudden they get involved in the system. They get placed in a foster home. They start running away, kind of similar to what Angela talked about. There are those group homes and people at the group home just can't control them. Now the police are calling them, so they're calling to the system now. So that's an additional pipeline. So those are two pipelines we can definitely talk about, that school to prison pipeline, and then this child welfare to prison pipeline, that between those two, so many of our children have gotten caught up in.
Right. Well, thank you, Judge. I'd like to shift, if we could, and have you hold that next thought to Darren Crawford. Darren, you also are a public defender currently in Racine. So I wondered if you could share the same ideas of your personal journey and your professional experiences, at least some of them, with our listeners.
Certainly. So I'm actually from Detroit, Michigan. That's where I was born and reared. And I guess when you ask what made me do law, I can share an experience that I think created the desire to educate myself and eventually pursue law. I remember being in high school and, you know, I was fortunate to have a car, and so that made me somewhat popular. and, you know, as a result, I always had a full car. And so I'd be pulled over a lot because there are a lot of young kids in the car, and I'd become accustomed to the fact that I'm going to constantly be pulled over. But I grew up in a household where my mom and my grandmother, my father was killed by a stray bullet. So, you know, my family took a concerted effort to make sure that I did things differently. Not to say that he did anything wrong to cause it. It was a stray bullet, but, you know, I didn't play with guns. I couldn't drive certain vehicles. I dressed a certain way. I went to a high school that pretty much, it was a business prep high school, so I wore a suit every day with a tie, or at least a sports blazer and tie. And so I fast forward a little bit. I think it was either my junior or senior year. I was a friend of mine and me, we were headed to my grandmother's house. I had convinced my grandmother to make us, you know, she had made some sweet potato pie, and me and my friend had a bet that my grandmother's sweet potato pie was the best. And so we were headed there, and we were both still in our blazers. I mean, he had turned his inside out because that was kind of the style. We tried to make it creative, and we had loosened our ties, but we were pretty much dressed consistent with that attire from school. And we had gotten to my grandmother's house. I had exited the car, and so did he. He was proceeding, and I was proceeding up the driveway. And a police car out of nowhere came behind us, and he instructed us to essentially get back in the car. And, you know, I'd been pulled over a number of times. I knew how to behave. I knew how to respond. But this was the first time that I'd been pulled over, but I really wasn't. I'd already parked. I'd proceeded up my grandmother's driveway. Wow. And then when I proceeded to go back to the car, he kind of pushed me on the trunk of my car, actually. And he was just started searching me. And, you know, by this time it was several vehicles, lights glaring. And I'm sure that caught my grandmother's attention, because my grandmother was and still is a very God-fearing woman. And she had poured everything into me that she knew. And so I'm a little bit embarrassed because my grandmother's never seen anything like this happen to me. And I would have never wanted her to see this. And so he's asking me and telling me I did something. Obviously, I had no clue why I was being accosted. Of course, they checked my vehicle. They patted me down, patted my friend down. They didn't find anything because there was nothing to find. And I remember his explanation as to why. I mean, it was really rough. He smashed my head against the back of the trunk, and there was no concern of my age. His response to me was, "I fit the description." And I was rather short. I didn't get a growth spurt into college, so I was pretty short. And I had a blazer on, and I could not understand how I fit a description of anything. I mean, my car was a Saturn twin cam, no windows, no rims, nothing that would fit a description of what was typically the description of anything. And so I left that conversation. Me and my friend, we didn't even eat the sweet potato pie. It left a mark on both of us. Mm. And, I think for me, I knew what was done to me was wrong. And I think there I made a commitment to kind of educate myself and figure out how I can not only fight for myself and my own rights, but other people's rights that would be trespassed against. And so I would eventually, I went to public schools in Detroit my entire life, but I eventually would go on to Morehouse College, which is also a historically Black college university, most notably known for some of its alumni, which include Martin Luther King Jr. And it's in Atlanta, so in the South. And then from there, I would go on. Actually, I was a math teacher in California before going to law school, because I was trying to debate between medicine or law. And I saw this opportunity to teach in a private high school, exclusive private high school in the Bay, well, really Marin County, which is across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. So I taught high school mathematics there for about 2 years. Then I went on to law school at University of Wisconsin. And from there, I started my work kind of in criminal law. And that would take me from, you know, Detroit. I was practicing in Detroit. I was practicing in Ann Arbor, which is Washtenaw County. I eventually came in, back to Wisconsin and practiced in Green Bay. And one, no matter where I went, no matter what arenas I practiced and how few Black people lived in those areas, what I found is my work always, most of my clients were always African-American or at least people of color, to the point where sometimes I overestimated the amount of African-Americans in a certain community and was shocked by looking at the demographic of a community or a particular county I practice in and learn that we don't even make up in some of those counties 5 or 4%. And yet my entire experience representing clients is almost typically exclusively people of color, and in particular African-Americans. And so currently I practice in Racine. I'm a criminal defense attorney with this public defender in Racine. I'm sure we'll discuss and share stories, but one thing I want to kind of punctuate the point. So I went and I became an attorney, and you know, which is the social engineer, to paraphrase, I think Charles Ogletree, but it might have been someone prior to him, but I know he wrote in his book. But you know, the individuals who are to advance culture. And I not so long ago, I was in Michigan, and I had, you know, as a public defender, we don't make a terrible amount of money. And so I decided to Uber. And I was Ubering at the time. This was when I was in Michigan. And at the time, I was still barred in both Michigan and Wisconsin. I was Ubering. I picked up an individual. This was in an area I wasn't, well, I picked him up from an area I was familiar with, which is a suburb of Detroit. But Uber, it'll have you take someone from one place to somewhere unexpected. And so I was in an area I wasn't familiar. And unfortunately, there was a don't turn on red, no right turn on red sign that I missed. And so I made the turn on a red light, a right turn, and the officer pulled me over. I pulled over immediately because I didn't even know I had done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And had my hands on the steering wheel. And as he approaches, I see him in my side view mirror, and he sees me, and then he draws his weapon. I immediately get nervous because this is also the time where there, you know, even before George Floyd, there was all of the other hashtags. And I'm thinking about, you know, my family and, you know, how I need to, you know, essentially cooperate in every way I could so that I can go home. And, you know, I didn't have time to record it or to do a Facebook Live or anything to document it because I didn't know what was going to happen. And of course, I complied, and his temperament was aggressive, to say the least. He questioned me extensively, and I knew that I could remain silent, and I had provided him the appropriate documentation, but essentially, he wanted to know why I was in the area I was in. And I think at some point he realized that, you know, there was another person in the vehicle, and I'm sure the passenger I had picked up was a white guy. And so at some point, and I can't be sure that that was the reason, but at some point the officer became a lot more relaxed, and he would go and eventually write me the ticket. And, you know, I felt in some respects very defeated after that exchange, because here I am, the protector of due process.
Mm-hmm.
The knowledge to do and know what I should do and do and be able to advocate for myself. But yet in that moment, I was reduced to to being my rights anyway, not being able to assert them in a way that I know other people would do without question, thought, or any kind of notion of harm. And so that taught me what I knew already, but, you know, some of us, unfortunately, we will always fit the description. And, you know, to be sure, he was scared of me. I don't know why, but I could see him when he pulled his weapon, I could see him shaking a little, which made me even more nervous.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, at some point we have to kind of, as a culture, as a community, as a country, address the concern that is kind of almost ubiquitous in a sense about my Blackness and what that means to his safety.
Right. I so appreciate all three of your stories, which are so profound and important for our understanding of everyday things that happen that a white person doesn't encounter. And I am so grateful for your taking time today to help us understand at a very personal level what these injustices are, so that we can begin to recognize when we perpetrate them inadvertently sometimes or advertently, whether, as Angela mentioned, it's a microaggression or outright aggressive police stop. It brings up some questions for us. Oftentimes in the cases of, as you mentioned, Darren, the hashtags that we've all become aware of, more exceedingly, actually, it seems, in the last couple years, of the people who have been victims of police brutality. Some of the questions that you hear from particularly white people is, well, if they'd only follow the rules. But as you have just described, all three of you, the rules, what are the rules? They're different. They're unspoken and learned and certainly unjust. And so in our second segment, we're going to talk a little bit more about what does it mean to follow the rules and some of those pipeline issues that Judge Childs mentioned, the school to prison pipeline, the child welfare to prison pipeline, and just what it means to have to live your life in this kind of ever-changing, nebulous, unjust society. So we'll have to stop for right now, but I really appreciate your time. We will hope that our listeners we'll tune in next week to hear more conversation with attorneys Angela Cunningham, Darren Crawford, and Judge Milton Childs. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.